KZFR Chico. Zephyr News is broadcast each Thursday evening from 7 to 7:30 p.m. This week's show features a contribution from the California Report. Segments from KZFR community members include coverage of the Paradise Town Council meeting by Matty Vannucci, a report on the future of Bidwell Mansion by Ken Smith, a piece on the Oroville Hospital by Matty Vannucci, and a recap of the Butte County Board of Supervisors meeting and other news items by David Foose.
With Zephyr News, this is Matty Vannucci. Oroville Hospital is suing its former CEO, Robert Wentz, accusing him of using the position to benefit financially from the multi-million dollar real estate deal involving the hospital. The lawsuit was filed August 4th in the U.S. Bankruptcy Court in Sacramento by Oroville Hospital and its parent company, Oro Health Corporation. According to Kira Gottsman with Enterprise Records, the suit names Wentz and two companies in which he owns a controlling interest, Dove's Landing LLC and Oroville Sports Club LLC. The allegation centers around the former Montgomery Ward building on Oro Dam Boulevard, now known as Dove's Landing. According to the lawsuit, Wentz formed Dove's Landing LLC in 2011 and held a 60% ownership interest in the company. At the same time, Wentz was the CEO of Oroville Hospital and also served as a trustee on the boards overseeing the hospital and Oro Health. The lawsuit alleges Wentz did not fully disclose his ownership interest in Dove's Landing to the boards. Dove's Landing purchased the property in 2012 for about $5.7 million. Instead of the hospital purchasing the property itself, Dove's Landing bought the building and leased it to Oroville Hospital. According to Gottsman, the hospital now claims that arrangement allowed Wentz's company to benefit while the hospital took on millions of dollars in costs. According to the court documents, Oroville Hospital spent approximately $7 million renovating the property. The hospital also paid rent to Dove's Landing during the years of renovation and after moving into the building in 2015. The lawsuit describes those rental rates as grossly excessive. It alleges the hospital's rent payments were used to help pay the debt Dove's Landing took on to purchase the property. The hospital says it was also responsible for expenses including renovations, property taxes, and insurance. The lawsuit argues that meant the hospital effectively paid for the purchase and renovation of the property while receiving no ownership equity in return, according to Enterprise Records. The complaint also alleges the hospital paid rent on approximately 5,000 square feet of space it never used. According to the lawsuit, those payments totaled more than $721,000 over the course of the lease. Another major part of the dispute involves a 2011 Memorandum of Understanding. The agreement reportedly stated that 51% of ownership of the property would eventually be transferred to Oroville Hospital as a gift, as long as the hospital remained an independent nonprofit and continued occupying the building. The hospital now argues the agreement and its financial obligations show the lease was actually a disguised loan or financing arrangement. The lawsuit also accuses Wentz of exercising significant influence over the hospital and Oro Health boards. It claims that trustees were dominated and controlled by Wentz and routinely approved financial decisions that aligned with his recommendations. The complaint alleges Wentz had influence over the company and employment of some trustees through hiring, firing, and promotions, giving him significant sway over their decisions. The allegations come as Oroville Hospital faces financial difficulties. Oroville Hospital and Oro Health filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in December 2025. Wentz resigned from the boards in February and stepped down as CEO in April. Now, the hospital is asking the bankruptcy court to reclassify the Dove's Landing lease as a financing agreement and declare Oroville Hospital the sole owner of the property, according to Enterprise Record. The lawsuit is also seeking the return of money and property allegedly obtained through the deal, as well as compensatory and punitive damages. The claims against Wentz and his companies are allegations contained in the lawsuit and will now have to be resolved through the court. Recording from Zephyr News, this has been Maddie Vannucci.
This is Ken Smith for Zephyr News. The Visitor Center at the Bidwell Mansion State Historic Park opened its doors to the public last Friday, August 7th, for the first time since the historic home was destroyed by arson in December 2024. Jennifer Pooley, Northern Buttes District Interpretation Manager for California State Parks, says the reopening was partly driven by requests from the public who wanted to see some activity back in the park, where the burnt remains of the mansion now stand behind safety fencing.
We reopened today on this particular date because it's the closest to John Bidwell's birthday, which was August 5th of 1819. And also because in the past year and a half we've been doing, or the past year, we have been doing outreach to the community to find out what they would like done with the park and what changes they'd like to see and what they'd like returned as well. So it's been one thing we heard from people over and over again is, can you at least have it open partially and open the visitor center so we can come see the exhibit hall and do some shopping for Bidwell related items. So we heard that and did a lot of work to get the place ready to go for public activity again.
Pooley says reopening the center gives the public more opportunity to participate in the Reimagine Bidwell Mansion effort.
So that is a state parks initiative to gather information from the public as to what they would like seeing with the park and for the future. So what kind of programming they'd like to see, what kind of facilities they want to see, what kind of visitor experience they want people to have here, because this is the time to do it. This is where we get to really take that in and form a park that's good for Chico.
State Parks has estimated the cost of building a new mansion at more than $37 million. Many Chicoans have expressed hopes that whatever replaces the mansion honors the native people who lived here before John Bidwell and worked the land that he occupied.
We've been doing ongoing consultation with the Machupta tribe, and so they're very involved in the process, and there's been a lot of interest around that. I know one thing that'll likely come out of this is State Parks started reexamining our past. It was an initiative started 5 years ago, and there's a real effort being done at all the parks right now to tell a fuller picture of history. So not omitting stories, but adding stories from underrepresented groups to provide a fuller picture of what was really happening and who was there.
The Reimagining Bidwell effort has a website where people can share their memories of the mansion and input about its future. A public meeting will also be held in September with a date to be announced. All of the information will be compiled and presented to state parks early next year. Lifelong Chico resident Annelle Reed was at the center reopening and shared some of her own memories and thoughts about the mansion's future.
When I was little, it was painted white, and then they painted it the original colors, the pink, and I think it's like a chocolate brown trim. So it's been part of my life, my whole life. And then my kids also grew up knowing the Bidwell Mansion and knowing about John Bidwell, and we would come to the birthday parties that were put on here for John Bidwell. And then we also went to like the Christmas open houses and the teas that were held in the mansion. I don't think they should rebuild it because it could never be original. So I think they should be sort of creative on how they remember the mansion, and I prefer that they maybe leave what remains and make it safe for people to walk around there.
The visitor center will be open Fridays and Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Programming will start again with a Junior Rangers series beginning in September and a pumpkin carving event in October. This is Ken Smith for Zephyr News.
This is Maddie Vannucci with Zephyr News. Nearly 8 years after the campfire devastated Paradise, town officials say recovery efforts continue to advance, with progress reported in housing reconstruction, road repairs, wildfire preparedness, and major infrastructure projects. The Paradise Town Council received its latest monthly campfire recovery updates on August 11th, outlining work underway across several town departments. The reports did not require council action and were intended to keep council members and the public informed about the community's long-term recovery. Housing continues to be one of the clearest measures of Paradise's rebuilding progress. According to the town, Paradise has restored 43.83% of its pre-disaster housing stock. There are currently 5,738 habitable homes, including 1,720 homes that survived the fire and 4,018 newly completed homes with certificates of occupancy. The number of completed homes increased by 39 in the previous month. Before the campfire, Paradise had 13,091 housing units. Affordable housing projects are also moving forward. 7 projects representing 292 units are eligible for funding through the town's $84.7 million Community Development Block Grant Disaster Recovery Multifamily Rental Housing Program. 5 projects have been completed, while construction is underway on the 72-unit Clark Road development and the 70-unit second phase of the Cypress Senior Housing. Road rehabilitation is another major focus as the town works toward paving nearly every public road mile by the end of 2026. As of July, 72.1 miles had been completed, 17.62 miles were awarded or under construction, and another 6.48 miles were planned. Knife River Construction is carrying out significant work throughout Paradise, including preparation, grading, and paving in several neighborhoods. Upcoming work includes arterial roads and portions of Skyway, while interim repairs along Skyway between Billy and Wagstaff Roads were scheduled for August. Wildfire prevention and emergency preparedness also remain central in the recovery efforts. All 21 towers in Paradise's emergency warning system are standing and operational, and active construction on the system is complete. Approximately 440 in-home safe warning units have also been distributed to residents, while the town continues testing and troubleshooting the devices. Paradise's Fire Prevention Division reported inspections of 11,198 parcels, with 85% meeting the town's defensible space and hazardous fuel management requirements. That is an improvement from 83% during the same period last year. The town's residential ignition-resistant retrofit program has 79 properties completed or undergoing work. Staff are working with the final 21 properties with the goal of completing the work by September 1st. Paradise is also moving ahead with a fully funded hazardous fuels reduction project expected to be completed by the end of September. Longer-term resilience planning is underway as well. The town received a $739,680 Extreme Heat and Community Resilience Program grant to develop a climate resilience plan. Potential projects could include evacuation, cooling and heating centers, shade tree planting, fuel reduction, and additional green spaces. Economic recovery efforts are expanding alongside the physical rebuilding. Paradise has established an economic development committee that plans to hold business sector summits to hear directly from local businesses. A workforce development initiative is also being expanded following a trial program with Butte College, with Paradise Unified School District working on classroom upgrades and equipment for a broader program launch planned for fall 2026. Meanwhile, work continues on one of Paradise's largest long-term infrastructure goals, a centralized sewer system. The town has pursued such a system since its incorporation in 1979, but officials say the need becomes more urgent after the campfire because inadequate wastewater infrastructure has presented challenges for rebuilding businesses and housing. Plans for the sewer system have changed after investigations determined that previously proposed percolation ponds were not feasible. The town council approved a revised concept in June that calls for a membrane bioreactor treatment facility and surface water discharge of treated wastewater. Officials are now evaluating potential treatment facility sites, continuing preliminary collection system design, and developing the project's environmental review. The town is also pursuing additional state and federal funding for the sewer project, including a $2 million request toward a $50 million U.S. Army Corps of Engineers authorization, and between $27 million and $75 million through a state water resource control board. While substantial work remains, the August reports show Paradise Recovery continuing to shift from immediate disaster response toward long-term rebuilding, infrastructure improvements, and efforts to make the community more resilient to future wildfires. With Zephyr News, this has been Maddie Vannucci.
This is David Foose reporting for Zephyr News. Bradley Scott Sayer, the suspect in the June 22nd shooting at the Chico branch of the Butte County Library, was back in court last Thursday, August 6th. A preliminary hearing for the case was scheduled for September 29th, 2026, in the Butte County Superior Court in Oroville. At that time, the judge will decide whether there is enough evidence to send the case to a jury. Meanwhile, Butte County District Attorney Mike Ramsey added three new counts of attempted murder to the charges against Sayer. Sayer had pled not guilty to two counts of first-degree murder and discharge of a firearm with injury during his arraignment last month. City of Chico Police Chief Billy Aldridge issued a press release in response to a news story about the police department sharing access to its license plate reader, or LPR, system with law enforcement agencies in states bordering California and also with federal agencies. Chief Aldridge first noted that the Chico Police Department has been using Motorola LPR systems since 2023 and does not own or operate any of the Flock LPR systems that have been in the news recently. Taking into consideration community concerns and evolving legal interpretations surrounding LPR data sharing, Chief Aldridge decided to conduct an evaluation of Chico PD policies and practices. During the evaluation period, use of the Chico PD LPR system will be limited to California law enforcement agencies. As to the question of whether Chico PD LPR data was shared with immigration enforcement agents, quoting Chief Aldridge from the press release, the Chico Police Department does not enforce federal immigration law, participate in immigration enforcement task forces, or use LPR technology for immigration enforcement. In fact, we have expressly disallowed use of our system for such purposes in our agreements with federal, state, and local partners from the start. Chief Aldridge then stressed how helpful license plate reader data has been in other types of law enforcement, such as criminal investigations, locating missing and endangered persons, apprehending suspects, recovering stolen property, and responding to threats. The Butte County Board of Supervisors met this past Tuesday, August 11th, 2026. The board proclaimed August 2026 as Child Support Awareness Month. During board member committee reports, District 4 Supervisor Todd Kimmelshue said he met last week with the Butte County Water Commission with the main discussion about data centers in Butte County. Supervisor Kimmelshue said it was a new issue for the county, which doesn't have any relevant ordinances.
This last week, we had a meeting of the Butte County Water Commission. And the big topic of conversation there happened to be on data centers and the possibility of data centers in Butte County. There was quite a lot of excitement over that issue. And I do want to compliment Director Daniluk for her explanation of Butte County's situation with data centers. This is relatively or very new to us. And nowhere in any of our ordinances do we mention data centers. So this is something we would be looking at, I'm sure, into the future.
There are four public comments about items not on the agenda. The first speaker asked government officials to admit their mistake and be accountable for forcing people to take the COVID vaccine and wear masks. The second speaker reminded the board that he had spoken multiple times in front of them and other government agencies about the danger of the COVID vaccine and asked when board members will do the right thing. The third speaker called the COVID vaccine a bioweapon, said she has been injured by taking it and has submitted a criminal complaint to Sheriff Honey. She asked why the board and sheriff were not taking action and said they owe the community the truth. The last speaker said he was going to address something else, but decided instead to support the first three speakers, said the vaccines have injured his family and friends, and asked why the board remains silent on the issue. A long presentation and discussion on the county's job order contracting, or JOC, policy followed. The board voted unanimously to approve a zoning code amendment to establish mobile food courts as an allowable land use in unincorporated areas of the county with standards for parking noise and trash disposal. The board received a presentation on the Palermo Master Drainage Plan. The purpose of the plan is to address long-standing problems in the area by supporting flood management, address flood issues, and public safety concerns. The presentation provided seven different options for addressing the problems, with costs ranging from $5 million to $20 million. The city of Chico is advising residents and visitors to exercise caution following recent water quality testing at Sycamore Pool at 1 mile that has shown significant fluctuations in E. coli levels. While some of the recent test results have shown safe levels, others have exceeded the recommended threshold for safe swimming. Therefore, the city recommends no water contact. Swim advisory signs have been posted at all lifeguard stations. California Governor Gavin Newsom announced that automakers are now offering instant rebates of up to $3,500 to Californians purchasing their first zero-emission vehicle, or ZEV. Right now, Hyundai, Lucid, and Tesla are part of the program. During August, Ford, Rivian, Chevrolet, and Kia join, with Toyota, Lexus, Honda, Subaru, and Mitsubishi being added in the coming months. Nissan and Volvo's launch timelines are still to be determined. Caltrans announced that it will be doing work this weekend from 5 p.m. Friday, August 14th, to 7 a.m. Monday, August 17th, on the VP2 Road Rehabilitation Project on State Route 99 in Tehama County. Construction includes roadway paving and widening, driveway and road connections, and improved pedestrian facilities. The project spans the area from southern Las Molinas to the Tehama-Butte County line. Motorists should expect delays of up to 25 minutes. Caltrans is alerting motorists that there will be overnight lane closures on State Route 162 in Oroville as part of a $25 million paving project. Work is scheduled Sunday through Thursday nights from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. until Friday, August 21st, 2026. And finally, the Community Action Agency of Butte County Incorporated, North State Food Bank, will hold a tailgate food distribution event at Pines Yankee Hill Hardware in Concow tomorrow, Friday, August 14th. The event will start at 9 a.m. and run until 11 a.m. or until supplies run out. There's no cost to those attending. Anyone attending should be in a vehicle and follow traffic flow guides. This has been David Foose for Zephyr News.
From KQED.
Good morning. This is the California Reporter. I'm Adi Bolaños in San Francisco. Goats have become a critical tool for wildfire mitigation here in California, but grazing companies warn their businesses are at risk now that wage requirements for herders have increased. Cap Radio's politics reporter Laura Fitzgerald has more on how the issue turned into a political fight between farmers and labor advocates at the state level. In a field of brush just north of Auburn in the Sierra Nevada foothills, a bunch of goats are grazing under the hot afternoon sun. You've maybe heard that goats will eat just about anything. Well, it turns out this makes them a great resource for getting rid of dense and flammable brush in wildfire-prone areas. These goats are munching on behalf of Western Grazers, a company that rents the animals out for wildfire mitigation. But companies like this one say they could soon go out of business. That's because as of July 1st, they have to start paying their herders for overtime. According to an estimate by the California Farm Bureau, that means a single goat herder would get paid around $240,000 a year. Tim Arrowsmith, who owns Western Grazers, says he can't afford to pay. He criticized labor advocates for the change.
They're messing with the livelihoods of us. They're messing with the livelihood of the herders, and they're messing with the safety of the general public who's not going to get the fire abatement using goats.
If he does go out of business, Arrowsmith says he'll have no choice but to sell his animals, and they'll likely end up in slaughterhouses.
They don't all go to retirement communities. Like, you know, people want to think that these goats are going to live this wonderful life afterwards. They're not. It's over.
Arrowsmith employs a handful of herders. These men move the goats around, protect them from predators, build fences, and care for herding dogs. They live out of trailers alongside the goats, often in isolated areas. These men are also typically from Peru or Mexico and come here on H-2A visas for work. Arrowsmith says he pays each herder around $60,000 a year.
It's a big job for these guys. They make, I don't know what, how many times wages that what they could make in Peru if they could find a job. And there's no Americans that want this job.
These herders often get paid for 8 hours of work a day. But according to California's agricultural overtime law, they would need to be paid for 24/7 labor. Brian Little is with the California Farm Bureau, which has been pushing to get an exemption for goat herders from the law.
And they can't necessarily, like I said, go to the grocery store or go to the movies or whatever the case might be. But they're also not working.
That's not how employee advocates see it.
You can sleep a little on call, and you get a different pay structure when you're on call, but you're still working.
Lorena Gonzalez-Fletcher is president of the California Federation of Labor Unions. She actually authored the Ag Overtime Law as an assembly member in 2016. Gonzalez-Fletcher says these workers are vulnerable.
They are isolated in a trailer without human contact watching goats. They have no path to citizenship. They have no other life.
Ultimately, the Labor Fed consistently opposes overtime exemptions for workers, even if that theoretically means goat herders would have to be paid $240,000 a year.
If any of us were asked to work 24/7, 365 days a year, and be on call every minute of every day, I would assume that we would think that that's a reasonable pay structure. If anything, it might be a little low.
It's a point that some lawmakers seem to agree with in the state capitol, where organized labor wields tremendous power. The California Farm Bureau fought for another exemption from the law earlier this summer, but weren't able to secure one before lawmakers left for their summer recess. They say they'll continue lobbying for an exemption through a budget trailer bill during the final month of session. For the California Report, I'm Laura Fitzgerald in Sacramento.
A Shasta County judge has blocked a number of controversial changes to the election system that voters approved earlier this year. Jefferson Public Radio's Roman Battaglia brings us this report from the courtroom.
Judge Benjamin Hanna granted a preliminary injunction Friday morning to stop Shasta County's Measure B from moving forward. The measure would make a number of changes Hanna said were in direct violation of state law, like hand-counting ballots and severely restricting mail-in voting. This ruling is part of a lawsuit the state attorney general filed shortly after the measure passed. Hanna said in his ruling that administration of elections is clearly a state, not county concern. He added that if the measure was implemented now, it would cause a lot of confusion for voters, potentially dissuading them from casting a ballot. Barring an emergency appeals court ruling in the next couple of weeks, Shasta County's November election will be conducted under state law, just like the one in June. For the California Report, I'm Roman Battaglia in Redding.
Zephyr News is produced by Trevor Parks, Lorenz Weissel, and KZFR volunteers. Listeners may send tips for stories to news@kzfr.org or by using the Submit a Story icon on kzfr.org. This program is made possible by the financial support of listeners like you. You can support KZFR's journalistic endeavors by visiting kzfr.org/donate. Subscribe to Zephyr News on your favorite podcast platform and share your thoughts on social media. Thank you for tuning in. We'll be back next week.